Thank Luis for organizing this and everybody for coming. So I want to talk about some matters that emerged from research on nonlinear instability of anti-de Sitter spacetime. So, but I had to make a choice between some general overview and something more concrete, but given that there are many people here working on this subject, it would be illogical to give a general overview. And I'll focus on a somewhat technical offshoot of this research, but it also has some flavor of recreational mathematics, so I hope it will be at least a little bit amusing, and at the same time it's justified by reasonably serious questions. But I will start with a general overview of how you construct nonlinear perturbation theory in anti-de Sitter background. And for that I will, so the interesting question is the behavior of gravitational perturbations of anti-de Sitter space, but I will present this in a simplified setting where a toy scalar field is used, a self-interacting scalar field, which turns out to be in many ways surprisingly similar to the fully gravitational case, though it also has significant differences, but it will give you a sense of the formalism, and then I will tell you in general how it connects to the gravitational case. And then I will focus on certain algebraic structures that are ultimately mandated by very rich symmetry of anti-de Sitter spacetime that emerge in an interesting way when you construct this perturbation theory. And I hope that this will be the somewhat entertaining part. But the general setup is that you start with D plus one dimensional anti-de Sitter space that I'm sure everybody here has seen, but just, you know, to keep this complete. One disclaimer I wanted to make is that there will be no archive numbers and very few references. Probably it will be more fair to the people who are present than to the people who are not present. But, you know, my papers are responsibly referenced, so everything is there. But here I would like to focus on the subject matter and not on giving credits. So anti-de Sitter spacetime is a maximally symmetric spacetime that can be realized as a hyperboloid type submanifold in spacetime, in flat spacetime with signature minus minus plus two times of dimension one less, and this is the equation that defines it. And the one reason I wrote it rather than just working with the metric is that eventually to reveal these algebraic properties that I'm interested in, it's quite convenient to go back to the embedding space. And this is the metric written in a particular set of coordinates that you may or may not be familiar with. So x, maybe somewhat counterintuitively, is the radial coordinate that runs from zero in the center to pi over 2 at the boundary. And this is the metric. It is conformally equivalent to 1/2 of Einstein's static universe, which is this part, half sphere times a cylinder, which will eventually also come up in the discussions. And the toy nonlinear equation that I will be considering and studying its behavior in the small amplitude regime is this equation. It may look somewhat abstruse. Yeah, so omega parameterizes the d minus one dimensional sphere that sits above every point of this two dimensional thing. So this equation is just massless scalar field with phi to the fourth interaction. So whatever seems abstruse to you, it just comes from this particular metric. This cosine squared is not a strange nonlinearity. The nonlinearity is just phi to the fourth. This cosine squared comes from this cosine squared, and everything else is straightforward algebra. So it's a particular equation, and it may seem boring to you that one would consider this classical PDE with a simple nonlinearity. It has very interesting behaviors, and its gravitational analog, if you turn on. So here the metric is frozen. There are only perturbations of the field. The case that has been studied the most and attracted, at least numerically, the most significant, it's when this nonlinearity is absent, but spherically symmetric metric perturbations are turned on. And then the main physical question is what these ripples do. And it turns out that the ripples scatter to infinity and come back, and each time they focus a little bit, and typically they form a black hole in the center. So the statement of instability is not that anti-de Sitter spacetime decays in any way. It's instability with respect to developing strong deviations from the original metric in a very small region due to focusing. And of course, from the ADS-CFT perspective, this is just thermalization. This black hole formation is thermalization in the dual field theory. So people looking at it from that perspective often say that it's extremely natural that it's unstable and black holes form. However, people coming from the PDE or general relativity side would think that it's very unnatural, and it was debated when it first came up. So that's the main question. I will not really get to this question of collapse, but I will be discussing essential mathematical features that are necessary for collapse. One thing is that if you start with small amplitude perturbation, in order to form a black hole, you have to focus it in a tiny region. You have to focus all the available region, energy in a tiny region of space. And that means that you have to transfer energy to very short wavelength modes, because that's the only way you can localize. And this transfer of energy to short wavelength mode is known as turbulence, and when it is only driven by nonlinear instabilities, and okay, it's well known that the space is linearly stable. The normal modes are written here, and I'll explain what they are. So the only way things can happen is through nonlinear instabilities, and when this energy transfer to short wavelength modes through nonlinear instability happens, that's called weak turbulence. So people discuss weakly turbulent instability of anti-de Sitter space. So one has to study transfer of energy between different normal modes of a different linearized normal modes of a nonlinear system due to small nonlinearities, and that's one of classical problems in nonlinear analysis. But here it has very unusual features that I will explain in a moment. And well, coming back to this equation, this is a toy setting where this transfer of modes occurs, and actually the initial transfer pattern is very similar to gravity. So I will just study this. So this is the general setup of the problem, and from now on I will try to explain how one goes about solving it, or attempting to solve it, and what are the subtleties involved. If there are any questions about sort of the general framework or its deeper justification, maybe if you think it's useless in this form, then I can try to explain to you how it is. No, so just ask questions, and in general, please ask questions. Dead silence. Okay,
of course you're taking the universal cover, so time is not compact.
Yeah, for the linearized problem, it's not important. Indeed, for the nonlinear problem, you consider these bounces of waves. So the reflecting boundary conditions are the conformal boundary. The field is massless, it goes to the boundary in finite time. It returns, it reflects and returns. And a thing that is provoked by your question, so I have to mention the relevant time scale on which everything happens, which will be very important from now on. You actually, for small amplitude perturbation, you need a gigantic number of bounces. This is because I'm telling you that you need to focus, but you're in this weakly nonlinear regime. So the smaller the amplitude, the weaker nonlinearities are, and the longer you need to do for the nonlinearities to have any effect. So both from numerical experiments and from this nonlinear perturbation theory, there is a natural time scale which is proportional to 1 over the square of the field. Well, it correlates with the power here, but actually this phi to the fourth has the same power and the same scaling as the gravitational nonlinearities in this case, so this is the relevant scale. So we have to discuss, it's actually sort of meaningless to say that you want to study weakly nonlinear dynamics, because you can study it on a fixed time scale. You have to specify how the time scale changes when you change your expansion parameter, and it requires different kinds of perturbation theory. So it's because you want to study it on this particular time scale that naive perturbation theory will not work, as I will explain, and you need the improved perturbation theory, and I'll explain how to construct it. So yeah, this is the setup. Okay. And so then one just does small amplitude expansion. And it is very natural to expand in the normal modes of the linearized system. So the linearized means a very simple thing, that you just replace this by zero, and then it becomes a linear equation in which you separate variables. And then you write this ansatz for the field. So it's a very simple thing. I mean, so you have expanded in linearized normal modes. So for the linear problem, each of these normal modes is just an oscillator with a certain frequency. So this is the coordinate of that oscillator, where I have introduced the complex amplitude. It's also very reminiscent to free field expansions when you start doing free quantum field theory. It doesn't matter. If the nonlinearity is turned on, these amplitudes are constant. Each normal mode performs harmonic oscillator motion. But if I turn on the nonlinearity, they will, of course, evolve. And I will first derive an equation for this, which is, of course, a triviality. And that equation is as complicated as the original one. But then I will explain to you why, in this particular small amplitude regime, that equation can be simplified. And that constitutes the improved perturbation theory. Now, I should tell you what happens if you try to do naive perturbation. You could, of course, try to do the dumb thing, to substitute and compute the next order correction. And that doesn't work, because in that correction, there will be so-called secular terms. So there will be terms that grow proportionally to t. So this is like the linear order, and the next correction will be cubic in epsilon, and you will obtain correction. So it will be epsilon times something. This is your first non-trivial order, and then there will be terms of the form epsilon cubed t times oscillating functions, which doesn't matter. So the point is that precisely where you want to see things, the second term is of the same order as the first term. So this perturbation theory is completely useless. It could answer questions on finite timescales that do not get stretched as you decrease amplitudes, but those questions are not interesting, because on any finite timescale, very small nonlinearity produces small effects. You want to be able to understand the effect of a small nonlinearity on timescales on which it does produce appreciable effects. That's the key question. And that is why you either resum, you can construct this naive perturbation theory, and there are techniques to resum it to get rid of these things. But that takes, this route takes a longer time to explain. So instead, I will tell you how to take a shortcut and derive the same system of equations but by a different procedure known as time averaging, and well known in the nonlinear science community. So before going there, I've written these terribly looking mode functions, but if I ever get to the real part of my talk, then I'll explain that in fact they have very simple and interesting structures, but this is the form in which they're usually given in the literature. So this is a family of certain orthogonal polynomials called Jacobi polynomials that I will not go into, and there are much nicer ways to look into this, but for now that's just what they are. These are spherical harmonics on the D minus one sphere. And most importantly, the frequencies are all integer. And that is a very special feature that very rarely exists in dynamical systems. So that would be called the fully resonant spectrum. Now, in the theory of dynamical systems, it is known, for example, that the name of Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theorem, that if all frequencies are non-resonant, meaning that you cannot find a combination of frequencies with integer coefficients that vanishes, then it is known that sufficiently small nonlinearity, there is actually it's not even a perturbative statement, there will be a threshold in the coefficient of the nonlinearity below which it has a small effect, uniformly small effect over all times. But here, we are precisely in the opposite regime. We are in the regime where all modes are in resonance. And that suggests that arbitrarily small nonlinearities can have, over large times, arbitrarily large effects. And that, of course, what underlies the subtlety of the problem and the complex phenomenology that emerges from it. So it is, in a way, seems like the worst case you could have. This ADS setting is the worst case you could have for being unstable with respect to nonlinear effects. However, it turns out that actually it's not as bad, because even if there are many resonances, the effects of many such resonances drop out from the effective equations that I will derive. So the system is very special. First, it is special in having the maximal possible number of resonances that can in principle exist. And second, it is special that the effects of some of these resonances actually drop out, and both of those features are mandated by the rich symmetry structure of anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so I had to write one very long, but this equation is completely trivial. You know, it may look long, but it is just substituting the expansion into that equation, after which, because I have chosen the normal modes to expand my field, then if nonlinearities are not there, then all alphas should be constant, because it just should be just harmonic oscillator motion. So that means that alpha dot should be purely given by nonlinearities, which means that it will be proportional to some power of epsilon. And all this terrible structure arises from just phi cube and nothing else. This is a product of three modes. Okay? So, and this is sort of a key beast, which is often called the interaction coefficient, which is this product of four ADS mode functions. And this thing has many special properties. So basically, this search for algebraic structures underlying these mode functions was driven by the issue of selection rules, that many of these things vanish. And that would be hopefully what I will get to eventually. But what do you do to this in practice? Why is it useful? So there is a theory, because this is a small coefficient, so in this small amplitude regime, there is a mathematical theorem that lets you simplify the system. So all of the functions involved here are periodic over one period of that circle, if you don't unroll it. So the mathematical theorem tells you that if this coefficient is small, then precisely on time scales that you want, you can replace this by its average over one period. The explanation is, and the mistake is controlled by a theorem, because the theorem tells you that you can make the mistake arbitrarily small uniformly on an interval that scales like 1 over epsilon squared with arbitrary coefficient if you make epsilon sufficiently small. So that gives you a way to simplify the system and approximate the equations, and it, in fact, I will explain to you in which precise ways it is useful. So this averaging is very simple. Here you only have exponentials, so when you integrate over one period, if all of these frequencies, the one here and here, 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 and the corresponding frequencies with one replaced by two, if they sum to zero, then it averages to something non-zero, and if there is any oscillation, your average over one period is gone. So the averaging simply kills most of the terms. And here where the resonance condition comes in, so I told you that resonances are important. So you precisely see that the terms that survive in the equation, they're in one-to-one correspondence with resonant quartets of four frequencies. So as I just told you, this is the expression of what I said. So in order for a term in this to have a non-zero average over one period, you need to have this relation where a priori all plus and minus signs are independent. If there is a relation like this, there will be a corresponding descendant of the storm in what's called time averaged equation or flow equation. And if it's not satisfied, the term drops out. So, but there is one trick that though a priori you could have all of them. In fact, only terms with plus plus minus sign survive. And all others have just, this thing will vanish. And of course, that this thing vanishes is a special property of ADS. It can be proved fairly straightforwardly using the properties of these orthogonal polynomials if you substitute them there. But that doesn't teach you much. And so one of the objectives was to understand what is the structure that mandates these selection rules. Now, once you know that the selection rules are there, so actually each plus sign here corresponds to alpha, and each minus sign corresponds to alpha bar because of the signs that they have. So the selection rule that I stated, that only these terms contribute, it guarantees that after you averaged, only alpha bar alpha alpha survives. And I have removed the indices here, not to write one more long formula, but the summation now is only over sets of modes such that this mode and these three together form a resonant quartet of this form with plus plus minus sign. So that's the result. And this has the fact that these terms drop out, it immediately has strong consequences. So this effective approximate system that approximates the original system in this particular small amplitude regime of interest, this system has exact conserved quantities that the original system does not have, at least not in a straightforward form. I think Stephen is trying to understand whether it's some non-straightforward form. So there is a lot of structure, and the fact that there are selection rules, it increases the number of these conserved quantities. And of course, you are studying the question of whether the energy can flow in some part. And the more conserved quantities you have, the more constrained it is. So it constrains the process. And this in turn enforces something called dual cascade, which forbids all energy being, so energy conservation by itself does not forbid all energy being transferred to short wavelength modes. But with the conservation laws that you have here, if some energy goes to ultraviolet, and there should be also some energy going to very long wavelength modes. You can prove it from looking at the conserved quantities only, and that's called dual cascade. Now, I should give some credits, at least to the people who are present, so that this dual cascade stuff, I think, comes from Louis Steven, and the selection rules have been discussed by many people, including ourselves, but this particular implementation with non-zero angular momentum, non-spherically symmetric case for a probe scalar field, this is Isham. And you, of course, for gravity, people always work with the spherically, almost always work with the spherically symmetric case because it's basically intractable either numerically or analytically to do the non-spherically symmetric case. And already in the spherically symmetric case, all this interesting phenomenology emerges. However, for the probe scalar field, you can write this in full generality, and you can see that the selection rules exist in full generality, and then we can try to understand. Okay. So you want to understand what symmetries force such integrals to vanish. And in the end, the explanation is quite simple, but confronted with that, we discovered a few curious structures that I will describe to you, and actually in the end it allowed us to solve a certain old problem in mathematical quantum mechanics that was not solved, so it's the accidental offshoot of our activities. But one can first ask what are the multiplets that these mode functions form. So in the equation itself, you have an explicit rotational symmetry of the D minus one sphere. And that, of course, explains to you why frequencies do not depend on this azimuthal quantum number K that labels different functions within the same angular momentum multiplet. So that's a consequence of rotational symmetry. However, there is much more degeneracy. So because all of these things are integer and it only depends on 2n plus l, there is a gigantic degeneracy for each level. So you can build these things, so there will be a ground state, and then there will be n equals 1, l equals 1, and here there will be, so it will go like this. So this is the frequency, and this is the angular momentum. And so each of these lines has many different angular momentum states, but nothing in the equation that you are solving straightforwardly tells you that this should be the case. And I mean, you are taught in your basic quantum mechanics courses that when your degeneracy is bigger than what you would naively expect, you haven't taken into account all the symmetry that you have. And you can ask yourself what the symmetry is. And, you know, Jaume, in a quick conversation yesterday, immediately suggested that this should be the isometries of ADS. But it isn't, because the decomposition of each level into angular momentum multiplets, so imagine you have some hidden symmetry group. So this decomposition should be governed by restriction of irreducible representations of your full symmetry group to irreducible representations of SOD. And here you have this decomposition in which L goes in steps of 2. But this can never happen in any restriction of a representation of any orthogonal group to SOD. They always go in steps of 1. So this is impossible. And the true symmetry group is, in fact, secretly SUD. And SUD indeed has this property, because irreducible representations of SUD are fully symmetric tensors, whereas irreducible representations of SOD are traceless fully symmetric tensors. Oh, not fully symmetric, the tensors with a given type of symmetry, but the tensors that appear actually in this spectrum, they're all fully symmetric tensors. But when you decompose fully symmetric tensors into traceless fully symmetric tensors, you have to contract two indices each time to subtract the trace, and that gives you angular momentum going in steps of 2, so that precisely has the right structure. And the way to reveal this structure is that you should look, so when you separate the variables, you have to study the eigenvalue problem for this operator. But it turns out if you make a simple change of variables, that is actually a conformal transformation that removes this factor and turns your space into Einstein's static universe. So if you do the corresponding conformal transformation for this operator, the eigenvalue problem turns into an eigenvalue problem that has been discussed in quantum mechanical literature, and it goes under the name of the Higgs oscillator. And the Higgs oscillator is a particle on a D-sphere moving in a potential inversely proportional to cosine squared of the polar angle. So this equation can be obtained from the equation that this mode function is. And this is known to be a very special system. For example, if you look at its classical analog, all classical trajectories close. And it is known that this symmetry has a hidden SUD symmetry. This system has a hidden SUD symmetry. And of course, the degeneracies are exactly identical because it's the same system. So it is known that in flat space, there are only two central potentials in which all orbits are closed. These are the Kepler potential and the isotropic harmonic oscillator potential. So there is a corresponding statement on a sphere that there are only two central potentials sourced from one point on the sphere for which all orbits are closed, and these are cotangent theta and 1 over cosine squared theta. They're in 1-1 correspondence. And the hidden symmetry groups are exactly the same for this pair and this pair. This one will have SOD plus 1, which is the famed Runge-Lenz vector augments the symmetries. And this one has SUD. So this quantum mechanical system was invented actually as a quantum mechanical analog of chiral sigma models for pions. And it was solved, and this degeneracy was seen, and then Higgs wrote a paper examining hidden symmetries and explained what the hidden symmetry group is. However, the generators of, so it's a heavily nonlinear system. And the generators of this, quantum generators of this hidden symmetry have never been constructed. So the classical generators are known, and the degeneracies of the quantum spectrum are known. Everything fits with the symmetry, but the generators are non-local operators. They are not operators with a finite number of derivatives. So they have never been constructed explicitly except for D equals 2, which Higgs did, and then he gave up. So basically, it's an offshoot of this activity we've been able to construct these generators, but I'm not sure if I'll get there. So it's just a little preview. So so this is one structure that emerges from that. But it doesn't give you an easy way to prove the selection rules. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the properties of the mode functions and how actually ADS isometries act on them, and a little bit about the relation of ADS isometries to these hidden symmetries. These are basically the generators of SUD are roughly speaking the squares of the ADS isometry. It's not quite true. So you can construct second order differential operators that are squares of ADS isometries, and they almost form an SUD algebra, but that the commutation relations do not close, because the commutation relations will be like something that looks like Lie algebra plus a correction of a still higher order differential operator. But then you can correct them, and that's what we did, and that completes the question of constructing the full generator. So anyway, there is a non-trivial relation between isometries and these guys. But let me come back to the isometries first. So I want to rewrite these terrible mode functions in a more comprehensible form, because they are fundamentally very geometrical. So I will remind you about a much more common problem. So you can consider spherical harmonics. And spherical harmonics by themselves are pretty nasty expressions. Well, instead of Jacobi polynomials, they will have whatever Legendre polynomials, so they're not very pleasant. But it is well known that for spherical harmonics, there is a very simple representation if you go to the embedding space, if you embed your sphere in a flat space. So there is a very straightforward way to construct this. If you think in terms of the embedding space, you just take homogeneous polynomials of these coordinates of degree L, And you say that these homogeneous polynomials are harmonic. The solutions to these equations, which are homogeneous polynomials of the flat space coordinates, are in a one-to-one correspondence. When you just restrict them to the surface of the sphere, you will get a complete set of spherical harmonics. Now, this is a much, and this of course known since whatever 19th century, but these are much nicer representations because when you write this in terms of spherical coordinates, you have upset all the symmetries of the sphere, you have picked your poles, it's not pleasant. When you write it in this form, everything is manifest, all the rotations are there, you can look how they transform. So it would be very, well, and ADS is the closest you can be to a sphere if you are a space-time. So it's natural to try to implement a similar program for ADS, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly, this hasn't been done. So there are a few places where these mode functions appear. In the ADS literature, probably this famous Brighton, Lohner, Friedman paper is it's quite straightforward to get there by separation of variables and looking through thick books of special functions. That is so maybe less straightforward to understand how to work with this. And then they are copied through the literature, and then there is, of course, a parallel stream of the same formulas in the Higgs oscillator literature, which is quite extensive because it's the same mode functions. So I want to think, to understand how I should think of this in terms of the embedding space of ADS. Yeah, I mean, I've just convinced Latham that, you know, that he shouldn't be my friend, I think. So I'll just tell you the answer without going through all the details. So you have to take a homogeneous polynomial of degree n. So now my capital N will label the level. So because the energy only depends on this combination, if I call it capital N, then N is just the frequency level. So I have to take, again, homogeneous polynomial of degree N in all of coordinates, x, y, and xi, that only depends on this combination on xi, but again, it's homogeneous in x, y, and xi, divided by this. And it has to satisfy the flat space wave equation. Flat space means that flat space with minus, minus, plus, 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 plus signature that my ADS hyperboloid sits in. And if all of this is there, then when I restrict this to the hyperboloid, I just get a mode function multiplied by its own oscillator factor. And of course, n plus, 2n plus l is m. So that's this two. So this represents the mode functions of anti-de Sitter space in terms of homogeneous polynomials, which makes it much more convenient to work with them, because now ADS isometries are just Lorentz transformations in this space. So I can write the generators in a very simple form. Now this capital IJ label all of my embedding space coordinates x, y, and xi. And this goes like this, the standard formula. So it becomes very easy to examine how these things act on mode functions, which is not necessarily the case there. And in particular, but there is one more There's one more blackboard here. Well, let me try to use this to the maximum. So in first of all, LXY is what would be called the dilatation generator, but in the ADS language, it just rotates the hyperboloid. And of course, the eigenvalue of LXY on the mode function is just the value of the frequency. Then the spatial part, it is trivial, it just rotates and it will transform this according to the angular momentum. So the interesting part is the part where one index is x and one index is spatial. And from those, it's convenient to form two combinations, which are like this. And for those of you who are familiar with the conformal group, this may all look very obvious, because these are the raising and lowering operator. I'll try to make it more precise. So you in general, for this conformal group SOD, 2, you split it into the dilatation operator, raising and lowering operator, often they're called P and K, doesn't matter, and the angular momentum. And these guys, they either increase or decrease the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator by one. This, by the way, immediately explains algebraically why the spectrum has to be integer mode, that all the spacings are one. So this feature that is so important in the nonlinear dynamics of the problem, it originates from simple algebraic properties of SOD, 2. And that sort of, these things are much easier to look up in conformal field theory literature than in any literature related to these problems. So, and in particular, those of you who are familiar with conformal field theory may remember how you construct, you have a primary operator, and then you construct all of its descendants acting with the raising operator. So once again, if I take, let me formulate it. This conformal field theory lore, and there is a completely down to earth level in terms of this mode function. If I take a function like this, and I act with L plus, I end up with a function of the same form, where this will be a homogeneous polynomial of degree one greater that still satisfies this, so it is a mode function at the next level and correspondingly with the minus. And this can be seen as a trivial consequence of having conformal symmetry for those who understand conformal symmetry well, or this can be verified explicitly once this representation has been given. So at the end of the day, you just take the ground state, which is E0, and which is completely trivial, can be written in this language. So in this language, the ground state is just this polynomial is 1, and this power is D. And you can construct absolutely any mode function. You can construct a basis that spans all mode functions by acting with L plus on the ground state. So I will call this combination of mode function with its own oscillating factor psi. So you can construct any psi at level n as a linear combination of these guys. And that's something that can be used to prove the selection rules immediately.
So it's obvious that it's going to be a complete set of?
You can count. It's quite easy to count. You see, one cheap way to count, but you have to trust me a little bit. But I told you that each given level forms a representation of SUD, which is a fully symmetric tensor. So that in particular gives you the number of components. Now you can count the number of different L pluses commute with each other. So L plus and L minus, of course, do not commute. The commutation is fixed by the algebra. But all L pluses here commute with each other. So this is a fully symmetric tensor of rank n, which has the same number of components that I claimed I haven't done the counting accurately, but if you just sum the multiplicities of these guys, you can check. But I think if you tell this to a conformal field theory person, they will tell you that it's obvious. There are even the lecture course. So after all of this was figured out, I stumbled upon this lecture course by Jared Kaplan, where this formula was kind of written. But then he was saying that you have to decompose it in angular momentum. So he, of course, he didn't know about the hidden symmetry structure, that actually this basis is superior. This basis actually reveals for you the hidden symmetry structure, and it naturally explains, or at least it naturally accommodates this degeneracy. It becomes much more confusing when you expand it in terms of angular momentum states, because that's not the natural language. So anyway, once you know this, you can prove the selection rules. To prove, so imagine, I will prove for you that one with all pluses does not work. So it's at zero. If this satisfied with all pluses, then the corresponding C is zero. So let me consider this thing. This 1, 2, 3, 4 do not mean that it's mode numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. It means that I have picked any four mode functions. I don't want to write indices. And now I say that omega 1 is omega 2 plus omega 3 plus omega 4. So I will multiply this by... So an unpleasant thing is that this is not an integral over the hyperboloid. It's an integral over one spatial slice of hyperboloid. That makes things, the isometries don't act naturally. But there is a little trick that allows you to change it. So I will multiply this by the complex conjugate of this factor. And I will multiply the other ones by that factor itself. So then this becomes psi 1 star, because I complex conjugated this, and these are these things. But now you see, I have, of course, multiplied by 1 because of this relation. Didn't change anything. So it still doesn't depend on time. So I will put dt here. So now I'm integrating on the hyperboloid. And moreover, if you check, this is the invariant measure of the hyperboloid, which of course respects all the symmetries. So now I'm in a good shape. I have a nice algebraic structures for these guys, and I have an invariant integration. I know how the isometries act. So now I will write all of them as these operators acting on the lowest one. And that's basically the end of the story. So the only two more things that you need to know is that L plus and L minus are Hermitian conjugate with respect to the invariant measure integration, but that's obvious because, I mean, they're defined as isometries. That should work, and you can check it explicitly. And the second thing you should keep in mind is that they are first order differential operators. So when you act with L plus on a product of two functions, you get L plus F times G plus L, or correspondingly with L minus, it doesn't matter. So then you just look at this. This has a huge number of L pluses, but because of complex conjugation, they turn into L minuses, and you use integration by parts to let them act on these guys. And by this property, all of the L minuses that you get will just get distributed in some ways between the different factors. But you can count the total number of L pluses here, and it's smaller if this relation is satisfied than the total number of L pluses here. So whichever way you distribute, they will give you at least one zero somewhere. There is no way to distribute them without zeros, and they will kill it. So that's the ADS isometry proof of the selection rules in nonlinear perturbation theory.
What?
That's
what I meant.
But you meant it at a deeper level.
Deeper.
Yeah, but we were talking about degeneracies. Degeneracies are not straightforwardly explained. These degeneracies are not straightforwardly explained by the.
Yeah.
Actually, I have 5 minutes, so I'll tell you two words about this. Our contribution to mathematical quantum mechanics. But indeed, you see, we were searching for a nice structure that explains it. And in the end, I think this hidden symmetry and isometries, they're a byproduct of this. I don't think in the end they're not very useful for this. The selection rule proof can be done with isometries at the end of the day. But I think it's in general good to know as many properties of this function as you can find out for constructing nonlinear perturbation theory. I didn't tell you too much about, I mean, there's a lot of rich phenomenology in how these energy flows governed by this proceed and how this correlates with the properties of the interaction coefficient. That wasn't my focus, but that's the primary reason why we are considering this. But yeah, so there may well be other properties. This is a rich structure that I think we should explore and keep in mind when we think further about the nonlinear perturbation. Now, the practical, if you're only interested in the selection rules, you just have to carefully understand how isometries operate on the set of mode functions, and that's the end of the story. Well, this is my Higgs oscillator. So I have 5 minutes left, but I'll just tell you two words about our contribution to mathematical quantum mechanics. So you may remember that for ordinary isotropic harmonic oscillators, so just p squared plus x squared, in d-dimensional space, there is a set, so the set of conserved quantities are L, which is proportional to xi pga minus xja pi, and something that goes under many different names, but it's a second order tensor, which is pi pga plus xi xj. And this is second order. Its trace is the Hamiltonian, so it's not independent, but the traceless parts gives you, so and this plus the traceless parts of this gives you the right number of generators for SUD. And it is a triviality, but it's a useful triviality to keep in mind. And this is a second order differential operator. So I told you that this Higgs oscillator is basically the spherical analog of this trivial isotropic harmonic oscillator. And indeed, you can write a neat set of second order differential operators that commute with the Hamiltonian. And that's not, of course, the way Higgs wrote them, because in the mathematical literature, it would be very strange to guess that this has anything to do with the conformal group. And that's actually why we could do something that quantum mechanics people could not do. I'll tell you a simple reason why. The dilatation generator is, roughly speaking, the square root of the Hamiltonian. And you know, if you just look at this as a quantum mechanical problem, you would never invent such structures. It's only when you map this to this Klein-Gordon equation in ADS, then in ADS it's completely trivial, and you look how things go. Basically, the reason is that the eigenvalue here is omega squared. Okay, this the second derivative. Okay, so this omega squared, and omega is the eigenvalue of the dilatation generator. But omega squared is the up to a constant, you have to shift it a little bit. It's the eigenvalue of this. So to guess these structures, you would have to consider the square roots of differential operators. Of course, nobody did. So this is not the way any quantum mechanics person would write it, but in our language, you can write this thing. And even though these things themselves, in the language of the Higgs oscillator observables, they are not differential operators. They are differential, not simple differential operators. They are differential operators in terms of embedding space coordinates, but not in terms of this combination is a second-order differential operator that you can check by computation. That it commutes with the Hamiltonian is trivial because this lowers the energy level by one and this raises the energy level by one. So it's a set of conserved quantities. And this, in fact, the set of conserved quantities that Higgs and his followers considered in those papers. You can check it. The problem is, so denote this Sij. The problem is that when you consider a commutator of two of these guys, then in order to get a proper SUD group, this should be something linear in L. So the split of SUD that into anti-symmetric tensor generators and traceless symmetric tensor generators, and then a commutator of two L's is L, a commutator of S and L is S, and commutator of two pairs of S generator is L. So that's what you should get, but if you compute it, you get something like this, which is a nonlinear algebra that doesn't close. And that's people who are discussing how, but there will be no generators that give you this commutation relation that are finite order differential operators. And this was an outstanding problem to construct it. So we constructed them, and I'll just to give you a flavor. I told you that the dilatation generator, to construct the dilatation generator in this language, which is exactly identical to that dilatation generator, doesn't look natural here. It's a square root of this plus some constant. And then you can construct explicitly L plus and L minus, which involve ordinary differentiations and this dilatation also. You can check the commutation relation. And then you can construct, you started with H, the Higgs oscillator Hamiltonian, and you construct D, well, I'll write schematical like this, you construct these things. And the generators that actually do have this property, do have the proper commutation relations, they of course have infinite number of derivatives, but it's a curious exercise in nonlinear algebra to construct them explicitly. So the structure is like this, there is a certain function that you can construct explicitly with some effort that I will not write. This function is of the dilatation generator and the angular momentum square. They commute with each other, so everything is well defined. And then you insert this thing, then you insert this function itself, then you insert this thing, and then you insert one more of these, and I think you symmetrize in these indices. So the structure like this and a particular choice of this function that basically, well, to derive it, you have to prove things basically, well, in algebraic terminology, in the universal enveloping algebra of SOD, comma 2, because you consider products of generators, but you can construct explicitly. And there is a choice of this function expressed through Pohammer symbols that for which you can prove that this very complicated, you know, infinite order differential operator has the right commutation property, which is something that resolves an old problem in quantum mechanics. Which is perhaps for me the most amusing part of all of this game, but also the most useless. So I think with this I'll have to stop, but more questions will be very welcome. And that's why it wasn't designed. There is quite some literature on this. And structures like this are called nonlinear algebras, quadratic algebras. It's related to quantum groups in a way. There are papers that connect. Well, in quantum groups, typically, it will not be quadratic. It will be some more complicated nonlinearity, like some commutator of generators is a sign of another generator, and there is a theory of representations of that. There are series of papers where Higgs oscillator is solved, because you've solved it already, but you know, for people algebraically minded people, it's interesting to solve it in different sophisticated algebraic ways. So there are papers in which properties of Higgs oscillator spectrum are derived from representation theory of these quadratic algebras and so on and so forth. But that is, it's a funny thing. So this is basically the only paper Higgs ever wrote. The only research paper, not review paper, that Higgs ever wrote after his famous Higgs boson paper. So for some reason, in 79, he felt that he should consider this problem, and he did. And of course, he never wrote about this again. What was that?
We were looking for all these years for this.
So the reason why this could never be guessed by people doing this from quantum mechanical perspective is precisely the square roots. I mean, you have to be completely, you have to be either Ramanujan or you have to be insane to consider, which perhaps is the same thing. I mean, one is subset of the other. To consider these structures after just looking at an ordinary Schrodinger. And you know, I would never imagine myself coming up with this if it was not completely obvious after you map it to ideas. So that's a strange byproduct of nonlinear perturbation theory and anti-decision space.
So if I take a theory of higher order nonlinearity, like with six turn theory, is it a four?
Say it again.
If I take a theory with higher order nonlinearity, say I have six turn in SC, is it a four? What can we prove?
Everything. Well, you proved in your paper using properties of orthogonal polynomials that this plus selection rule will hold for arbitrary self-interaction of the scalar field.
Is there more? Because in when there are four of them, you're saying that the plus is missing. It's also saying that they're up. You can put two omegas on one side and two omegas on the other side of the equation.
Oh, you're asking about this plus, minus, minus.
Yeah, and when I have six terms, and I say three omegas have to be on one side and three omegas have to be on the other.
I haven't thought much about this. But it's true that sort of you can explicitly analyze simple cases in which this plus, minus, minus. No, but wait, I mean, if you have like, well, for this nonlinearity, plus, minus, minus, and plus, plus are the same because you put it on the other side and rename frequencies. So you know cases when it's not this? Or you're saying that these sort of non-minimal things, when you cannot reduce them by reshuffling to
six.
I strongly suspect that all of those are non-zero, but you know that some of them are zero.
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. If you don't know that some of them are zero, I will voice my suspicion once again. I would expect that they are all non-zero. But and I don't see immediately how from this structure selection rules for this non-minimal sets of plus minuses that you cannot reduce to pure pluses. I don't see how. It,
Pauline, you mentioned that by looking at the embedding structure, it was easier to understand the structure. Do you see, by taking that point of view, perhaps other conserved quantities or other things that maybe in one more higher order? Do you see a pattern here emerging somehow?
Well, this is not directly related to conserved quantities. So these are not hidden symmetries in your dynamical system.
Right.
It's a hidden they're hidden symmetries in an auxiliary system that emerges in this construction of perturbation theory. So for me, I mean, I would go from these properties to properties of the interaction coefficients, and then the properties of the interaction coefficients determine which conserved quantities you have here. So the short answer is no.
We have no more questions. So Oleg is here till Saturday morning or something.
Yeah.
And he's somewhere in the, so let's think of me.